Okay, good morning everybody, and welcome to ITE 2, Module 5. Now due to some technical difficulties, Cherylyn will be with us just as soon as her computer decides that it's behaving itself. Okay, today we are looking at Introduction to Network Operating Systems. And we're going to look at the remote systems that allow administrators to efficiently maintain their networks. Now, this is always a good thing for blind people because remote access is one of the best ways of getting access to networking systems. Sometimes actually sitting in front of the keyboard and screen on the server isn't particularly useful. Okay. We'll also be talking about the directory service, which allows people to control the servers from a global perspective. You have to reset Ventrilo up again. Okay. Now, the directory service, which is a very important part of networking, provides administrators with the ability to centrally control usernames and passwords. So we're looking at directory services such as NDS, which was Novell's one, LDAP, which is Lightweight Directory Access Protocol, and Open Directory, which is Microsoft's one. And we'll also talk about other NOS services that allow you to share files and print. Okay. Networking operating systems are designed to provide network processes to clients and peers. And you're looking at services such as file sharing, World Wide Web, mail, printing, exchange, directory services, remote administration, all that sort of good stuff. Now, remote administration using protocols such as Telnet, SSH, RDP, all those sorts of things allow you to manage servers that are miles and miles away. You can actually, it's probably worth mentioning here that WindowEyes comes with support for RDP by default, so Windows Terminal Services. It also, however, if you have JAWS, you have to pay extra for that. I think, and I'm interested to be corrected on this, I think System Access allows you to use some sort of remote control stuff over it as well. Okay. The stars don't tell you the number of characters, I don't think. Okay. Yeah, there we are. Now, let's see if your audio works.
Testing 1, 2, 3, 4.
You're back. Okay, I'll just keep on ploughing on, and then you can catch me up. Yep. Now, under Windows, they're called services. And if you're anything like me, one of the first services you stop taking full responsibility for doing so is the Security Center service, because I get sick and tired of being told that I have no firewall. They are called daemons or daemons in Linux, and they're called NLMs or Network Loadable Modules in Novell. Essentially, they all do the same thing, but they're all different just because everybody has a different idea as to how you implement these things. They're not always enabled, so you have to decide which ones are going to be enabled and which ones are going to be disabled. And it goes without saying, from a security perspective, you should only have the services that you require enabled on a server, not every service that is actually available. A lot of these things do work over TCP/IP, and TCP/IP really is the most dominant protocol for sharing all sorts of different services, because just about everyone implements it, even Novell, who ended up moving from IPX-SPX to TCP/IP in version 4 and version 5.
Okay, Okay, I'm just going on to AutoVox, and I'll let you finish that section, Kerry.
Okay, I'm just going to take. I was actually going to. Yeah, alright, I'll finish that, and then I'll go off AutoVox. Okay. Okay, and it's probably a good idea to make sure, as they say in the notes here, that you only start up the services that you need to start up, because all sorts of denial of service attacks and worms and nasties out on the internet stop you from being very productive and can actually take your services down. Some key network services will be needed to be enabled manually, and I think that's about the end of that section. We're up to page 4.
Page 4, okay. So we're talking now about remote access. That will be about where we got to, I think. Okay, thank you, Kerry. I apologise. We had a few little glitches this morning, as we sometimes do, but we seem to be back in action at the moment. So, okay, so remote access, which is really important these days as a network user, especially with our mobile lifestyles, where we're wanting to, you know, operate our computers and be able to have multiple locations that we're operating them from. Some of the things that we might use remote access is, say, if you're a business person and you wanted to access, you're at one branch and you want to access the network at another branch of where you are. Also, you may be someone who's working from home but needs, you know, from time to time and needs to be able to access the office network. So, It's as many people these days working from home are exactly doing that. Okay, and the more we become a global economy, the more we need that remote access. So you can even use it, you know, if you need it on a sort of an occasional basis, and you were just wanting to log into your work network and see what's happening on. So you can use your remote access server, log into the network, and use your normal account that you use when you're actually sitting at your desk working in the office situation. A lot of people refer to that as telecommuting, sort of doing it over the airwaves instead of getting on the train and the bus and flogging your way in. You're commuting with your network, which is a really good thing to be able to do.
Interestingly enough, though, I saw a documentary on the ABC last night called Virus Wars or something, and they were basically saying that it is rather concerning that a network as insecure as the internet has an incredible amount of critical infrastructure connected to it, such as banks, power stations, water stations, and all sorts of other infrastructure services such as transport. And we are in serious danger of actually having a serious meltdown if somebody were to attack those core services. So, interesting.
Absolutely, yeah. So, we refer to terminal emulation as the way that we access your remote desktop server by the local computer terminal. So what happens is the local terminal runs the software, and that emulates, and what we mean by that is it mimics or looks for the remote system terminal. So you can actually type commands and execute your programs on the remote system, just like you're sitting there, which is really good. So when you're using a Windows system, you can run a terminal emulation program in one window and have your applications running in another window. There are different types of terminal emulations that are used for specific types of terminals. And we have the most common terminal emulation program, the one that we use, is Telnet. And that is part of the TCP/IP protocol suite. Now with Telnet, you have a command line interface, and what that does is it allows the client computer to access the remote server. And all of the Windows, Unix, Linux, they all support Telnet services. The Xterm utility is a terminal emulator for the X window system. And T which is big T, little t, is that module that runs the GUI in Linux. Okay, the well-supported version of Xterm is the X386 version, but there are other versions that you can get, and that's a sort of very well-supported version. You can use terminal emulation to deliver applications and services to your clients, and also, you know, from your point of view as an end user, you have the high-end application running locally on the client machine, but the reality is that the application is run on the server, and normally servers are a sort of more powerful machine that's running and serving your client services.
Now, they do that here, actually. They have all of these old crusty workstations that really should be thrown out and stamped on, and then they run WinFrame and MetaFrame and stuff, and then all the telemarketers basically just have a keyboard screen and underpowered PC on their desk.
Yeah, pretty poor, aren't they? So, as I mentioned, Telnet's the main internet protocol that we use for connecting to your remote machine. And it gives you basically the opportunity to be on a one computer system and to do work on another. It provides error-free connection. Okay, remember that. That's somewhere in your exams, I believe. As Kerry was talking about, though, there are security considerations that you need to think of, like hacking, denial of service attacks, those type of things. And we're going to be talking more and more about, and also utilising Telnet services as we go along in IT2. Scrolling, just seeing what we need to do. Okay, when you're configuring your remote access for your client, if you think most of your computers are connected to the network on a permanent basis, and they're doing that normally with your system's network card, they're done through assigning IP addresses to the system, which we've talked about before. And but when you're establishing a remote connection to a computer, in needs to be done through logging into that remote computer. You need a telephone connection, dial-up, or ISDN or broadband connection to connect to the remote computer. And we can do that through a point-to-point protocol, or PPP, and we can use that to establish a TCP/IP link between the two computers using a modem. Okay, point-to-point protocol is really been designed to use for only short periods of time. And it's not considered an always-on internet connection. Anyone tell me what might be an always-on internet connection?
I'd be sort of saying that broadband is considered always-on, and because it does use PPP over Ethernet, that we would probably consider that in 2009 PPP is an always-on connection pretty much. They still use it because it's easy for them to keep accounting records so that they can bill you into next month. So yeah, you still do see a lot of PPP connections.
But yes, certainly broadband. Okay, there are a couple of ways to create a PPP connection. One is to configure the PPP using your text-based PPP utility. And another is to use a GUI dialer. Okay.
Now, it talks about how to do the PAP secrets and the CHAP secrets and stuff, but if you want to know how to do that, I think you should probably read your notes and the man pages for those two particular files on the Linux system. They are responsible for setting up the authentication to your remote system. There are text-based tools these days that you just go PPP config and feed in all the information, and it pretty much goes like a mad thing most of the time.
If you're using a text-based version, there is in your notes, if you go in there, there's you need to have an entry in the /etc PPP /PAP-secrets or the CHAP secrets file, and you can edit those two files in the same format, and that allows authentication between the two computers. Now that uses a challenge handshake Authentication Protocol, or CHAP. Okay, so the other one, the file also uses the Password Authentication Protocol, or PAP. And they CHAP and PAP are protocols that present your username and password information. So if you're going to edit those files, you would have to put in the username, password information that you have via your ISP. And you'd also need to enter the name of the server or the computer that you want to connect to.
Now, I've really got to stress this, people. When you go to set up any sort of internet connection, don't rely on your computer to remember the password, because so many people just type it in and goes, but my computer remembers it, so I just click connect.
Yes.
Of course, when your computer gets hit by a virus or a Trojan or a worm and it gets trashed, you then no longer remember what your username and password were for your internet service provider account. If I had a dollar for every time I said to people, so what's your username and password for this account? Can you type them in for me? And they go, these are two pieces of information you should know. I mean, you all know your own phone number, so why not know your username and password for your internet service provider? Unless, of course, you don't want to be online, and that's okay too.
You can actually substitute the value with an asterisk too, then that'll connect you to any server or computer. And the last bit of information you'd need for the secrets file is the IP address of the system that you're wanting to connect it to. You can leave that blank and that'll allow connection to any IP address. Okay, so there is a little bit more in your notes there on that, so I just direct you to those, because you're not going to remember everything I say there. But I will briefly go over, that's sort of the using the CLI and editing those commands. But you can also do it with a GUI dialer. You can edit your configuration there. And you use that through a dialing utility. The GUI PPP dialer that comes with KDE is the KPPP dialer, and there is a whole lot of information about actually step by step there to configure your KPPP dialer. So I would direct you to your notes there as well, because there's a whole lot of steps that you can have a look at.
And you'll probably be using the GNOME dialer if you're vision impaired and using the GUI, because I do not believe the KPPP dialer is accessible. So if you're helping somebody set that up, definitely refer to those notes. Otherwise, you'll probably be using the GNOME utilities to do that.
I'm going to have a go, folks. I'll catch you later.
Cheerio.
Okay, Leanne. Take care. Okay, an alternative, another way is using ISDN. And it's an alternative to using your telephone lines to, you know, you establish a connection through ISDN. One of the advantages of ISDN is speed. Uses a pair of 64 kilobits per second and digital lines to connect, and it provides about 128 kilobytes per second throughput. So it's much faster than using the telephone line of
128 kilobits per second. It's a small
bit. What did I say?
You said kilobytes.
Oh, sorry. I apologise. Yes. Kilobits per second?
Okay. Yeah, sorry. We have to be pedantic about that in data comms, unfortunately.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay. So when instead of using your modem to connect to your remote computer, with ISDN, you use a terminal adapter. Essentially, it is the same role that the modem plays in a PPP connection. So it's a terminal adapter is an external device, and it acts like an external modem. You can have a internal devices, and that would plug into a PCI slot in your computer. And obviously, they're called ISDN modems. You'd also need your proper drivers and all that sort of thing to make that all function. Okay. Remote connection We've all heard of DSL, or cable modem service is another way we can have a high-speed remote access, or broadband remote access. And that's provided by your ISP, and it's obviously you're going to get faster speeds. And say, for example, with DSL and cable, you're going to get a range of 1,000 kilobits per second or 3,000 kilobits per second. And that's going to vary. With the new cable, it's going to be faster.
I was also going to say
fiber optics.
I was going to say with ADSL 2 Plus, you can get a theoretical maximum of 24 megabits per second, but you'd better be living next door to the exchange to get those sorts of high speeds. A lot of other people tend to get 18, 16, or 12 megabits per second, depending on their distance from the telephone exchange. But we are told that Ruddy is going to roll out a big new fast fiber optic network, and we're all going to have very, very, very fast internet. I wonder if it's by 2050, though. I'll be sort of a bit old by then, and they'll be able to download that stuff incredibly quickly. And obviously, it'll be interesting to
see... And I won't be here.
it'll be interesting to see if we actually still get volume charged, though.
I'll be up there in that broadband in the sky, hopefully.
Cloud net or whatever.
Cloudness. Either that or I'll be extremely old. Okay. All right. So there are a number of ways, obviously, four ways that broadband ISP is going to assign IP addresses. Can anyone tell me some of the ways they are done? Anyone pre-read their notes?
I think Scott might be asleep or on the phone or something.
No, I'm still here. Sorry. I was a very annoying thing that just happened. That's all right. Some of these people are a bit amazing. But anyway, I'm back.
No, that's
okay.
Fine.
Any idea how they assign IP addresses on DSL and cable, considering you're it this morning? Any idea?
I think we've got somebody else there. I think Suprita's there. Hello, Suprita.
I thought they were through.
I think there are.
DHCP.
Yeah, that's one.
Yeah. Another one's PPP over Ethernet. Anyone else know any others? There's PPP over ATM, or PPPOA.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Yep.
I always
forget. And in fact, If you're sneaky on Australia, you can actually use PPPoE or PPPoA, and if your modem is flexible enough, you can actually get a slightly increased packet size by using PPPoA and not clamping the maximum segment size, and get a few more bytes per second out of your internet connection, if that's the sort of person you are.
Okay, now if you're the person looking after the server, and you're configuring remote access for people, or you need to have, as the administrator, make sure that you're making access rights, you know, following your local policy wherever you're working. Just like if you've got people sitting in an office, you're going to have to make sure that you're, you know, if you're the administrator, you're going to have to make sure that you're controlling who can get on locally. If you're the administrator and you're looking at remote access, you've got to make sure that you're following all the rules to make sure that the people are getting on remotely as well. Another thing we've talked about is security, and that's especially important too with remote access. So you need to have firewalls in place as well. So, and we've talked about firewalls before, but I'll just reiterate, it's like a barrier between one network and the internet. So, and obviously, if it's remote, you're still going to have firewalls in place between the two networks.
Okay. Of course, you can install a router that can block undesired traffic in and out of the network. And one of the manufacturers of those routers is Cisco Systems. They will cover all of your router needs, at a price, of course. But you could install a Cisco firewall, or, for example, a PIX router, which is a packet internet exchange device, and you can buy those from Cisco at a certain costs to your company, but it will provide a level of security that you otherwise might not get. I just thought we should mention our sponsors.
Just a word from our sponsors.
They're very expensive, those routers.
They are. I mean, you can get a regular Linksys for about $130, and yet an 878 will set you back about $800
or $900. I saw a $2,000 one the other day.
They're very good, though. Although, one of the things I sort of mentioned is by the time you've spent $2,000 on the router, you could have bought 20 of the cheap ones. And I've never even, not even I've managed to bang 20 of the cheap ones yet.
Yeah, I've got to get a good one. Mine's kind of old. It's one of those Linksys 54G ones.
Okay. Have you installed one of the Linux distributions on it? Because, I mean, that makes them a lot better, like OpenWRT or something.
No, I've got to find it, and then I'll put it on. I'll have a play, and I'm going to do that this weekend. I've got the place to myself, so I can actually get this place secure and working properly.
Yeah, it's always good. I always find that when you've got significant others, that taking the internet down is a good way to get them to squawk.
That'll work every time.
Well, you think I'm going to test the Cisco? Yeah, we've got a Cisco router that I've got to test out so that before we can bring it back in here. So I'm going to be doing that tonight before the significant other turns up tomorrow, because she will not be happy if I take the internet down.
Yeah. No, you can just say that that's how a regular Australian internet works.
Yeah, that's right. We'll do that.
That would be mean.
Yeah, what happens is, you see, there's a kangaroo that goes bouncing past a signal box and it knocks out the ADSL. I mean, what do? You just have another tinny.
Exactly.
And your connection works until the next kangaroo bounces past.
Yeah, we call it skippy internet.
Skippy internet.
Sure. Yeah, I think
of course there's a koala
archive and make this. Yeah.
Yeah, they hug to the lines.
Yeah, that's the one.
Okay, back to the lecture, I think.
Okay, now we're sort of starting now in the nitty gritty, because we're getting into the talking lots and lots about Linux, which is Kerry's little pet things. So, and you're going to get, as we go along in IT2, going to be talking more and more about Linux as we go. So, using Linux for your firewall services, you can use Linux uses IPFWADM IP chains and IP tables to configure the firewall functions.
Now, I remember there's a question in the test on this. IPFWADM is used for kernel 2.0, IP chains is used for kernel 2.2, and IP tables is used for kernel 2.4 and 2.6. Yeah, I think we need to know that.
Now, what was that, Kerry?
IPFWADM is kernel 2.0, IP chains is kernel 2.2, IP tables is kernel 2.4 and 2.6.
So you've been warned, it's in the test. Okay. You can either configure them manually or using your GUI as well, and you can also configure the firewall using Linux via a website. Whatever you do, you're going to have to sort of, particularly if you're doing it manually, you're going to have to look up the literature, because it can be a little bit complicated, and
it is,
and really,
really
need to know what you're doing.
Complicated.
It is
really complicated. Yeah. In fact, I look at it and I make a really strong cup of coffee, and even then I still get a little bit scared.
And take a deep breath.
I do, just like I do on Skype. Because I think that the thing with the thing you've got to realise with these things is, if you make a mess of your firewall configuration and you're configuring it over an Ethernet port, it's quite possible for you to lock yourself out of your own machine. Yes, I did that on a Friday night to a remote system once and couldn't get back in until Monday morning. So one has to be careful.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I've done it. I did it to one in the US. It just happened to be my hosting provider.
That's always good when you do that. And you had to get somebody to reload the image back onto the server or something, just to get you back in.
Yeah, so I set my alarm for, I don't know, 2 a.m. or something, got up and called them and went, by the way.
Yeah, it's all good.
Oh, no good. Okay, so you can, as I say, manually is a little bit tricky. There are GUI configuration tools that you can use, such as Firestarter, GuardDog, and a number of others. You can configure them using a web configuration tool. And what happens there is that you enter whatever the information is needed, and then the website will generate the firewall scripts for them.
Now, I recommend Shorewall, S-H-O-R-E-W-A-L-L, www.shorewall.net. That is a very blindy-friendly configuration firewall utility. And interestingly enough, just for Scott's benefit, there is also a version of it that runs on OpenWRT, so how about that?
Okay, TCP wrappers are also used in conjunction with INETD.
I was just about to do a wrap about TCP, but then I thought I'd better not.
You can do the wrap on that if you like.
Yeah. If you're setting up your computer, you better not guess. You better make sure you sign the right IP address. Then when you got it, the thing you do last is you go and you assign the correct subnet mask. Anyway, that's enough of that. Move on.
Okay. how do I go on after that?
You just
that,
need to
goodness.
Get Jaws to wrap now.
I have the Jaws wrap, actually. You've heard Jaws wrap, have you? Yeah, it was a bit lame.
I know, but it was just the way the timing was clever. So if it was done with better words and things.
Yeah, anyway. Okay. TCP wrappers we're talking about now, and not the Yo variety.
Okay, they use a program called TCPD, and so what happens is when using that TCPD, the INETD program calls TCPD first, and what happens then is the TCPD program checks to see if the client that wants to access the server is able to do so, and then the TCPD program allows the client to access the server.
Oh, and there's an interesting gotcha here, which I'll mention to people in case they come across it. By default, Debian and Ubuntu and Red Hat add a line to host's deny that says all colon paranoid, which means if you can't reverse map the host, don't let them in. So if you don't have a reverse map in your etc. hosts, your telnet sessions will look as though they hang for 60 seconds and then time out. So that's actually part of TCP wrappers, so just be aware of that. You don't tend to have that problem with SSH, but if you are configuring telnet services, which I think one of the labs makes you do, it's worth making sure your etc. hosts has reverse maps for the machines that are going to telnet in.
If you're wanting to configure your TCP wrappers, there's two files that you can edit, which is the etc. hosts allow and etc. hosts deny. And that will, as it sounds, allow or deny access to the system. So if you're, say for example, using the hosts allow file, you're actually specifying who or is allowed to gain access to your system.
And funnily enough, the ones in the host deny tell them that ones that you don't want to allow access, ironically enough. And if it's in the host's allow file, it's allowed access, and if it's not, it's probably denied access, unless it's got other rules to tell it not to. And you can read about those by reading the host's underline access man page, which is in section 5 of the man pages, and we'll tell you how to read man pages with a web browser later on in the course, because I was nice to you all, and on the Debian machines that I've set up, you can read all of the web pages in all the man pages in a web browser.
So some of the entries in those files, you've got the daemon list, and that's lists, as it sounds, the names of the servers that are going to be appear in your etc. services, and again, that's the servers or the services which you're either going to be granting or denying. It's also got the XINETD, that is X-I-N-E-T-D, and that's the number of Linux distributions use that conf file, and that allows the configuration by the server to access or determine the parameters.
Now, just so you know what the INetD is, and because it's not actually really explained in these notes or very well, INetD or XINetD is what we call a super server, and basically it listens on a whole series of sockets, which you'll learn about a bit later in the course, and it then fires up programs that are going to be fired up based on the configuration files, such as Telnet, POP, and things like that. So you can either have standalone daemons, or you can have them launched by INetD. And it's generally considered good practice that if the daemon is going to get high usage, that you have a standalone daemon. However, if it's going to get low usage, that you actually spawn it on demand from XINetD to save server resources.
Another file in there is the bind, and that tells XINetD to listen to one network interface for the service. And for example, you might have the entry bind equals 10.2.5.1, which will cause your router to listen to that specific Ethernet card address on the network. Another one is the only underscore from, and that works similar to the host's allowed file. So you can specify the IP address and your network names and all your host names. The no access works similar to your host deny file, in the way that your entries are listed on the line, and those ones will be denied access, as it sounds, to the server. Obviously, another way that you're going to control remote access to a server is by password protecting it. And you know, you really need to be mad not to. otherwise, you'd have every Tom, Dick and Harry trying to telnet into your remote server.
Actually, it amazes me how many people steal wireless access from open access points with absolutely no regard to people's data and security and stuff. So interesting how the world has changed.
Except if you're at McDonald's. But I guess they're
the ones at McDonald's are free, though. Yeah, and I think you're allowed to use those.
I know my next-door neighbour has free, has open wireless. I've been trying to convince them to secure it for a while.
I suppose if you do live near Macca's, it's kind of handy. You can just hijack their access point. you don't even have to eat their coffee or drink their food. But, yeah, I mean, essentially... yeah, that's kind of cool. Although the other danger of being at Macca's and stuff is make sure you've got your firewalls and stuff configured, because you can always go back through the access points and try and hack into other people's computers that might be eating the coffee and drinking the food. Yeah, war burgering at Macca's, yeah.
Yeah, that works.
Okay, the other thing too, bear in mind, is that you need a program that's going to encrypt information if you're sending passwords. So... FTP, POP, IMAP and Telnet send your password information in an encrypted form by default, but some don't. Another way that you can encrypt your passwords and data is using SSH protocol, and it's designed to make sure that everything's secure and your passwords aren't going to be intercepted.
I think it was Bianca who always, every time we say SSH, she says, SSH or I'll bash you. And if you're a Linux user, you'll get the joke and groan very loudly.
Yes.
and if you're not, then you'll move on. Yeah. bash being the born-again shell, just for those people who, we do come across that later in our notes.
Oh, we certainly do. Okay, so SSH is something you ought to come across a lot from now on too. Okay, file permissions are another security option which will allow you to set up who can access what files on the server. And for example, if you had a Telnet or SSH server that people needed or clients needed to access, you could specify a group or a directory that the users could have access to. So that's also important as the administrator to set up what files you want your clients to be able to access and what ones you don't. And that's the same in corporate environments. You'll find the administrator in the office, they'll sit there and they'll say, well, this people here can, these five people can have access to everything, and the rest of you will restrict, and you'll have different levels of permissions, access permissions set up.
Just a bit of social engineering here. Don't give people all of the permissions and then take them away. They're going to lynch you on the way to lunch. Make sure that you don't give people the permissions to begin with and only grant permissions on an as-needs basis. People do not enjoy having their permissions restricted and taken away from them.
Okay, Linux works as a very reliable and very good server. And it allows a number of ways in which you can remotely administer your system. So it's a convenient way, and it's got a number of tools for remote administration. So it's got text mode logins, GUI logins, file transfers, and dedicated remote administration protocols.
I like OpenVPN. Anybody wanting a free VPN solution for Windows and Linux and the Mac, check out www.openvpn.net. Advertisement ends.
Okay, text mode logins consists of logging into a system using Telnet or SSH. So you can Telnet or SSH to remotely administrate your Linux server. And it's typically done by logging in with a user account and using the su command. You're going to have lots of fun doing all this soon. with your root password, and that gives you super user privileges. The correct command syntax that you would use using Telnet in Linux is Telnet space hostname. And the host name would be the DNS name of the system that you're attempting to gain access to. When you're using SSH, though, it's obviously a similar process, but it doesn't use the login. It uses login colon prompt.
And you can use dash L, and for SSH you can use dash L and the login name to change the login name that you're logging in at. Otherwise it will pass across the default username by default. Can anybody give me a reason why you would use SSH over Telnet?
Well, it's more secure.
It is. It also supports data compression, which is very important over low bandwidth links.
Okay, so you can also use a GUI to log in, and the software you would need to have installed on your Linux server is X Server, and you'll probably find that that's been pre-installed, hopefully. okay, right, file transfers. You can transfer files using FTP. We'll get there in a second. And that allows you to...
I was just going to say, they don't generally call this administration, but it is ways of transferring files backwards and forwards between your Linux system and your Windows system. One of the common mistakes that noobs make, as we call them, or people who are new to Linux, or newbies, depending on how you want to say it, is they use some file transfer utility to rip all of the configuration files down onto their Windows machine. They edit them in Notepad, and then they push them back up to Linux, and they don't pay attention to what the end-of-line command characters are, and because they didn't change the end-of-line markers, the Unix utilities reject the configuration files, and it all goes very bad. So make sure you pay attention to the fact that your files need to be saved in the correct format to have the correct line endings if you're going to pull them onto your Windows box and edit them there.
And no spaces in Linux.
Or you can have spaces in file names, but most of the configuration files don't have spaces in them. Go ahead.
Linux is really cool too because it's got a number of tools that you can use for remote administration to make things easier. SNMP, the Samba Web administration tool, or the SWAT, and Webmin. Any others that you can think of, Kerry?
There's LinuxConf. There's another thing. Munin. No, that's for monitoring. There are a couple other ones, but Webmin is one of the big ones and stuff, along with LinuxConf and the ones you've mentioned.
And I'll just sort of talk a little bit about each of those. Say, for example, the Samba Web Administration Tool, or SWAT. It's a web-based tool, and it's used to administer, as it sounds, the Samba server. And you can access the server remotely using your web browser. It uses port 901, and that accesses the SWAT administration page. And then you type the URL of the server that you wanted to access remotely, followed by port 901. Webmin, as the name implies, is another web-based administration tool, and it was designed with the main concept being that it can be used on Linux distributions, and it can also be used on Unix systems. It's installed using port 10,000, and to access the web administration or webmin administration page, you type the URL and then follow it by 10,000.
Just a warning here with these web administration tools, a lot of people think that just because the tool puts its user interface up in a browser, that any idiot can use it. I've actually had a couple of situations where some people who had a little bit of knowledge, which can often be a dangerous thing, cut sick in the web administration tool and made a complete mess of most of the configuration files on a server. So do try to know what you're doing. It really does make life a lot easier.
Another thing we need to talk about is Armon. I'll try and say that again.
Armon.
Armon.
Have you been drinking rum this morning?
Yeah.
Rum almonds. Almond rum. Oh,
yeah,
I want some of that.
That's the one. Or remote monitoring.
How about remote rum?
I can't even say that.
Come on.
Is this the point at which I point out that Elise runs a podcast called Clean and Free for people who are recovering from alcoholism? Because we might need it after this one.
I tell you what, when you're talking for an hour or so, the tongue becomes your worst enemy. Yeah, give me some rum, I might be right. What it is a standard monitoring specification, and it allows various network monitors and your systems to exchange that network monitoring data. The secure shell, or SSH, is the one that we use most frequently, and it's a remote administration tool for Linux, as I talked about earlier. It gives you command line access over an encrypted tunnel, so you've got more security, as Kerry mentioned earlier, than you do have with Telnet. Many of your Linux distributions are going to come with SSH server already installed. Okay, once you've got your SSH server installed, whether it's pre-installed or you've done it, you would have to have a few settings in place to minimise risk, and they would be your permit root login, and you would set that value to no. Okay, and you would also have X11 forwarding, and that value would be is used for getting a graphical connection. You can set the value to no, otherwise you would set it to yes. That's pretty obvious, isn't it?
Interestingly enough, they've actually changed their opinion on that. They used to actually tell you to set permit root login to no because it would increase security, but then it was discovered that super usering in your terminal emulator and having a keylogger running on your machine would expose your root password. It was actually safer to set permit root login to yes and have keys. So the upstream and SSH has actually changed the defaults on that, just so you know. So permit root login should probably be set to yes by default on most modern Fedora systems or CentOS systems. You can actually change that default to no if you feel that would make you more secure, as the notes suggest.
Okay, we all know what an intranet is, as opposed to an internet.
I do, but I think I'm exempt from answering, so yeah.
Oh, you can answer, go on.
An intranet is a network that is created inside a company. So, for example, if the association had 6 offices, you could have them all on intranet and connected to each other. They did used to have 2 offices, one in Wellington Street and one here, and there was an intranet that connected those 2 offices together sometimes.
Hmm. And these days we've got really large intranets. For example, you know, you might have some big corporation, they've got a huge intranet. And obviously, you can have thousands of users, and they're all going to need different services and different, you know, levels of security, what you want them to be able to access. Okay, there have obviously had to be ways of managing those intranets, and the system that we use is called Directory Services. Okay, so that's a supplemental management tool from just what you use in a network operating system. So in the directory service, the top object in your directory obviously holds all of the other objects, which is called the root objects. So with directory service, it gives you, as an administrator, a centralized control of all your users and also centralized control of all the resources that you have on your network. So it gives you, as the administrator, the opportunity or the ability to organize all the information and to simplify all your management of the network. And as I mentioned, that's really important if you've got a huge network that's running a number of different operating systems and you've got different protocols that you want to implement. When you've got a directory service in place, you, as the administrator, can centrally manage all of your resources, and it makes life a lot easier for you. So those directory services that you're setting up can be either local, where you've got one or two machines, or you can have them spread across multiple machines. And when we do that, we refer to it as a distributed directory. Just had Jaws crash. Won't be a second, I'll just relaunch him.
In the computer world, you may be familiar with a directory being a different thing, such as a file or folder, but there are actually two definitions, or more than two definitions, for the word directory.
You'll have to scroll down, Kerry.
Benefits of using a directory structure. It saves you a lot of time. Your changes can be replicated to all servers without you having to replicate them by hand. Data can be easily organized. Data can be easily secured. The data can be easily located and accessed, provided you know how to access a directory service, of course. Also, it's good because you can have a centralized permissions database and stuff, and you can change the inheritance on permissions and stuff in the directory service to allow or deny users access to their files, and that bit is not in the notes. And because all the shared resources are published by the directory services, you can have a user logging in from anywhere, and their permissions will follow them around.
Directory service standards is next, but... yeah, okay. Thank you. We're having fun this morning. Just had to relaunch Jaws then. Okay. We also have a directory service standards. So obviously with a lot of things we need to have a standard to operate by or within. And without those standards, you know, you'd have... applications, you know, they need to use their own directory, and that obviously is going to require more disk space, and also your the products, say for a vendor, would have to use databases that were compiled by other vendors. So it'd be sort of very difficult to have a functioning directory structure. There's also a standards compliance directory service for vendors, and it designs their services so they're compatible over a range of platforms. The X.500 defines the electronic directory service, or EDS standard, and the directory services described in X.500 are designed to work in conjunction with X400 messaging services. 3 major components or primary components of X500 is the Directory System Agent, or DSA. And what that does is it manages the directory data, the directory user agent, or DUA, which gives your users access to the directory services, and the directory information base, or DIB, which what that does is it acts as a central data store or database in which your directory information is kept. Okay. Sorry, you want to say something, Kerry?
No.
Oh, I thought you were, sorry. Your X500 compliant directory services uses directory access protocol. Now, what that does, or DAP, is it uses, enables the DUA to communicate with the DSA. Okay, and it defines the way in which your users or your end users can search the directory, and whether they can read, add, delete, or modify directory entries. The DAP is a powerful protocol, and obviously, because it's powerful, it's associated with high overheads. You can get a lightweight directory access protocol, or LDAP, and that was developed as a subset to DAP, and it was used to simplify access to your X500 type directories. And it's a popular standard, and it's used uses fewer system resources than DAP, and it's pretty easy to implement. Current version of LDAP is LDAP version 3, and it uses it's got more improvement over the earlier versions. LDAP version 3 supports SSL, which stands for Secure Sockets Layer, encryption between your client and your server, and enables X509 certificate authentication. Okay. Windows 2000 Active Directory. When we had the release of Windows 2000 Server, there were fundamental changes to the components of the network, and there were changes made by Novell in transition from NetWare 3 to NetWare 4. Active Directory was central to the changes. So where you had the Novell NDS functions as a service that was working with the network operating system, the Microsoft Active Directory functioned as an application integrated within the operating system. So you had an Active Directory database structure. There was Active Directory log files, and and also shared system volume. So the database is the directory, and the log files record the changes made to the database. The shared system volume, or SysVol, in that you have scripts and group policy objects on Windows 2000, you have domain controllers. What I mean by group policy is the means by which, say, the Windows 2000 server administrators control the desktop users and how they deploy applications and set up their user permissions or user rights. The logical structure of the Active Directory is based on units, which we refer to as domains. Although with domains in Windows, they function differently from what they do in, say, for example, Windows NT. When we're using NT or Windows 2000, a domain represents a security and administrative boundary, as well as a replication unit. With NT, it uses a flat domain structure, and with Windows 2000, it arranges the domains in a hierarchical domain tree. The hierarchical tree concept works differently in Active Directory than it does in NDS. Where when you're using NDS, it doesn't divide the network into domains. With Windows 2000, the networks can have multiple domain, and when we have those multiple domains, they're organized into a domain tree. You can actually have domain trees. When they're joined together, they become forests. I seem to recall that's in your exam somewhere. With regard to forests, the term Microsoft uses, it's used by Microsoft as a collection of an entire domain tree, and that is included in the Active Directory under hierarchical structure. Active Directory uses organizational units to organize the resources within the domains. So you can have administrative authority can be divided or delegated into individual organizational units. Active Directory also uses DNS naming conventions, and it's actually dependent on DNS to operate. So you need to have a DNS server on every Windows 2000 network. In addition to that, you need DNS zone information where you can have updates that can be integrated within your Active Directory replication. Windows 2000 supports DNS, or Dynamic DNS, which is DDNS, and that enables automatic updating of your DNS database. When you're using Active Directory, you need to have at least one server configured as the domain controller. They actually recommend, though, that you have at least two domain controllers in each domain. And that the reason for that is that it provides you with fault tolerance. Okay, when you're configuring the first domain controller on your network, that creates the directory for the domain. Any questions up to now? I know it's heavy going.
I'm back, folks.
WB.
Okay. Replication. When we're talking about Active Directory replication, when we're referring to replication, we're talking about the process of replicating or copying data from one computer to one or another computers, and also synchronizing your data so that it is identical on all of your systems. Active Directory uses multi-master replication. And what that does is it copies your directory information between the domain controllers that are in your domain. And you can have changes made on your domain controller, and the changes that you make are then replicated to the others. Okay, obviously security is an important issue. So each object in your Active Directory has that access control list. Oh boy, you're going to hear lots more about that, or ACL. Now, what that access control list is, as it sounds, it allows permissions associated with it. So you can have permissions either explicitly allowed, or on the other hand, you can have them explicitly denied. There are two different types of permissions, the assigned permissions. And what that is permissions that are explicitly granted by whoever is authorized or an authorized unit, or you can have inherited permissions. Now, what they are is permissions that apply to, say, for example, a child object because they were inherited from your parent object. So, as it sounds, it's an inherited permission. You can have permissions assigned to individuals, or you can have them to a group of individuals or users. And when you're using Windows 2000, it allows the administrator to control who is assigned what levels of permissions. Now, with regard to Active Directory, it's dependent on the operating system and runs only on Windows 2000 servers. Okay, and there endeth Module 5, which is quite a full-on module, I know, quite deep, because we're really sort of introducing Linux. And if you haven't had much to do with Linux, you will get more and more familiar with it as we go along. Any questions before I have a couple for you? Okay, so we got three people on IR, I think. So we can probably have a little bit of a mini quiz and just see how you go. So if you can have your chat windows open, we'll do a bit of a quiz on today's module.
Okay, so questions? If you've been dozing, it is now time to wake up.
Wake up.
Wake up for the quiz.
Wake up. Wake up, you sleepy heads. Okay, on the web, which protocol handles client requests and server transfers? Is it A, HTML, B, HTTP, C, IE, or D, FTP? Go now. You can join in this, Kerry, if you like, because we don't have many.
I thought I'd just better type it rather than ask what the options were again, because I thought that would just be really tedious.
Yeah, it's B, HTTP. Okay, what are the most common web servers found on the internet? We want two here. Is it A, Netscape Navigator, B, Microsoft LLS, C, Apache Web Server, D, Linux, or E, Mozilla?
I'm not sure what the other one is. I know C's.
B and C. The Microsoft the Apache.
Yeah. That's Microsoft IIS, by the way.
IIS, sorry, I said LLS.
That's why we all got confused. We're like, what is LLS? Is that
Loser? Yeah, no, I'd never heard of it. I was looking it up.
Yeah, Loser Logic System, you know.
Yeah, that'd be.
Oh, that's my fault. I apologise.
So if we all get it wrong,
okay. No, you'll remember it now. Okay, three. What is script? A, a text program used for automatic tasks. B, a series of password username combinations for a new user. Or C, a list of tasks for the user to perform. Yes, you're correct. Yes, you're correct. A text program used for automatic tasks. Okay, what is the order in which print jobs, this is interesting, are typically queued and processed? Is it, this is in your test. I remember this one. Is it A, last in, first out? Or is it B, first in, first out? C, randomly, based in the proximity of the user to the printer? Or D, sequentially, based on the distance of the printer from the user? Clever cookies.
I actually had somebody who believed that a print queue was like a toilet, and if you put a really big print job in the top, it would force all of the little jobs out. We had to explain to him that no, there really was no similarity.
Jeez.
Okay. Okay, now this one. Which two statements describe FTP connections? Is it A, they require a special FTP software application? B, they can be established through GUI programs? C, they can be initiated using a web browser program? Or D, they can be established using a CLI?
There's about three that I would
know. Oh, then. Hang on. No. Yeah, there's three.
Well, I was going to say A, C, and D, but...
Yeah, so was I.
Well, I would expect there would be three there too. But the official answers there are B, they can be established through GUI programs, and D, they can be established through a CLI.
It is just coincidental that most web browsers do allow you to open FTP connections. We've got an amazing delay. Somebody must be downloading, just so we know. But we're almost done, so it doesn't matter.
Okay. What is the overall purpose of DHCP? Is it A, DHCP can only assign the default gateway and IP address to the client? B, DHCP reduces the work necessary to administer a large IP network? C, DHCP can only assign the DNS server address to a client? Or D, the HTTP allows the resolution of domain names to IP addresses. And the answer was B. DHCP reduces the work necessary to administer a large IP network. Okay, one more question. Why is it beneficial to use shared network printers? A, it increases the length of the printer queue. B, it is more efficient, to put a printer on every workstation. C, it decreases the number of printers to be purchased and managed. Or D, it encourages employees to work together. Interesting match, aren't they? Interesting list, I should say.
I was actually trying to track down the delay, so I wasn't listening, but I would say that it is allows centralisation of printing resources and stuff.
Yeah, it decreases the number of printers you need to purchase and also decreases the number that you have to manage, which was C. And there endeth the quiz. Oh, somebody got it right after we'd said. That doesn't count, folks, does it? Okay, so any questions that anyone has that you'd like to answer? I know that's quite heavy going to go. It was hard enough trying to speak it.
Actually, given the delay we've got on our link at the moment, I don't think we can blame the answers for coming in late, because we're actually quite delayed.
No, yeah. No, that's fine. We'll forgive you. All right, well, I guess we'll probably sign off there. And Kerry is back on Wednesday for... Discovery 2, and I'll be back with you next Friday. Next week we're talking more about computer operating systems and network operating systems. Surprise, surprise. Okay. Well, thanks everyone for bearing with us, and we'll talk to you soon. And Kerry and I'll be available on Skype.